It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, surveys show that inflation and the broader economy are on many voters' minds as we move toward the midterm election. How about you? We'll talk about the politics of inflation and the economy as election issues. First, the late-night television talk show landscape is set to change in the coming months, and the changes come as the future of the late-night format is in question. Earlier this year, James Corden announced he'll be leaving the Late Late Show next spring. More recently, Trevor Noah said he's stepping away from The Daily Show in December. Last year, Conan O'Brien ended his 28-year run as a late-night host, and TBS got out of the talk show wars entirely with the cancellation of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee this summer. The changes come as traditional late-night talk show television ratings have been declining since the heydays of Jay Leno and David Letterman in the 1990s. As more and more viewers and video content switch to online streaming, it leaves an unclear future for late-night talk shows that once dominated American popular culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch late-night talk shows yourself in real time, or do you watch funny bits when they pop up on some form of social media or YouTube the next day? Were these kind of shows once part of your regular viewing at night, whether we're going back to Carson or Leno or Letterman or pick your era? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Coblin is a media reporter for the New York Times covering the TV industry. He's co-author of the book, It's Not TV, The Spectacular Rise, Revolution, and Future of HBO. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me on.
Before we get into some of the specific changes lately, can you talk about the big picture trends that led from, you know, the only game in town pretty much was talk shows at late night for a long time, and now not so much?
Yeah, you know, you did a great job summing up all these departures that are coming up. And this has happened in late night before. In 2014 and 2015, we saw Jay Leno, Dave Letterman, and Jon Stewart all depart at relatively, in a sort of truncated period of time. And at that point, 7 or 8 years ago, the entire television industry and news media was interested in on the short list. Who's going to replace these hosts? There's something different about these departures this time. When James Corden announced he was leaving, the president of CBS said, we're not going to stick with the same old host behind a desk format. We're going to think about something else. And Trevor Noah's replacement for The Daily Show, that might be a multi-host reformatted show as well. When you talk to producers in the late night field, they say that there's something different this time. And the something different, diminished ratings, less revenue. NBC is considered spinning off Seth Meyers' 12:30 show on NBC. They've considered spinning that off to MSNBC. So it's a pretty challenged genre. And I think it is fair to ask the question at this point, what is the future of the late night show?
Yeah, the content of late night shows doesn't necessarily fit well with streaming, right? The Game of Thrones, say you watch that when it first breaks or 2 days later or 2 years later, still the same show. That topical monologue at the beginning of a late night show doesn't make sense 2 days or 2 weeks later.
Yeah, this is probably the biggest challenge. As we've seen with both scripted entertainment and even unscripted entertainment, it has made the transition from network television, cable television, to streaming very, very nicely. Late night shows depend on topicality. They depend on what people are talking about that day, or at least within the last few days. And that is not how people experience streaming entertainment. Netflix was brilliant. They really made a hard effort to make a talk show work 5-6 years ago. They gave a talk show to Chelsea Handler. They gave one to Joel McHale. They gave one to Hasan Minhaj. None of them worked, and all of them were canceled. Hulu, similarly, they gave a show to Sarah Silverman. That was canceled after only a handful of episodes. Apple TV Plus, they just gave a show to Jon Stewart. The second season recently began, but the first season really had a tough time garnering significant attention. So late night, as we know it, going back to the Johnny Carson days, and then evolved by David Letterman, and then spun forward by Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Fallon and Stephen Colbert, that show where you have a host who does a monologue, sits behind the desk, does a funny sketch, does a celebrity interview, that just does not work on streaming.
Before he announced he was leaving The Daily Show, Trevor Noah was asked by an audience member what he thought the future of late night comedy would look like. Here's what he said.
content is evergreen, right? There will always be content. I think when we consume content will change. Like some people go, this is a late night show. Some people don't think of it as a late night. They just go, it's a show. Then some people don't even think of it as a TV show. They go like, I love your show on YouTube. I love your show on TikTok. I love you on Snapchat. I love you on Facebook. I love, like, there's some people who go, if I go like, I have a TV show, they're like, what TV? Where? And they have no clue at all. My brother taught me this, my younger brother. He doesn't watch TV at all, but he's seen everything that's on TV.
Do you see that changing the content, John, where, okay, as opposed to doing something that's going to work in my live broadcast, I'm going to do something that's going to work for people to click on YouTube or Instagram or whatever?
Yeah, I think we saw that change when Jimmy Fallon took the reins of The Tonight Show in 2014. He really was creating content for it to go viral on YouTube. James Corden as well. That's where Carpool Karaoke began and became a huge hit. It became a huge hit on YouTube and not necessarily on CBS. The difference between now and then is the ratings have fallen even farther from where they were 8 years ago. And most significantly, the revenue has diminished. Most producers I talk to believe the genre will continue in some way in 5 or 10 years. It's just going to look radically different than it does today, mostly because we have to figure out how does this work on the internet? How does this work digitally?
We're talking with New York Times media reporter John Coblin about changes in late-night talk shows and where they could go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think the late-night talk show plays in American culture or played past tense in American culture? Is there one you still watch live or do you catch up the next day on? Fill in the blank there. Did you used to consistently watch one of the late night talk show hosts? Who was your favorite from the days of yore, whether that was 3 years ago or 30 years ago? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with here's John Coblin, media reporter for the New York Times, who covers the television industry. With us today, looking at changes coming to late night TV talk shows and the challenges those programs face in the streaming age. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the future holds for late night talk shows? What question you have about the changes that have been happening that may be coming in the future? Do you care who replaces James Corden on The Late Late Show, Trevor Noah on The Daily Show, or if those shows go away altogether? Was there a show in the past that, yeah, you really watched that all the time? What changed for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Mike is with us in Waukesha. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mike?
So it was interesting. I'm just driving on my way here in Waukesha, Wisconsin. I got to go pay a bill. But we were talking about why the late night people like Trevor Noah and why these shows are, let's say, being off the air, canceled, what have you. I have a suspicion that it's content as it relates to what people are calling the woke agenda and the woke mentality in which late night used to be entertaining. It used to be funny. It even provided a little bit of variety. If you ask me, you know, the days of Carson, even Letterman, Leno. But what you didn't see the political push, it seems. And there's a saying out there. It says, get woke, go broke. While other people on YouTube and on internet are doing quite well, the Rogans, the Tim Pools, Jordan Peterson, Russell Brand, they're growing. They're huge. So I don't necessarily think it's technology somewhat. I just think it's content, really.
Mike, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. We had another caller who was also worried about politics on these shows, liberal politics, they said, sneaking in. What do you think, John?
I mean, it cannot be discounted. Obviously, it's a factor. You know, ever since, much the way America has gone, late night television is gone. Once things started getting more divisive, and particularly when Donald Trump entered the fray in 2015 and then won the election in 2016, we've seen many of the late night hosts take on a more political bent to their shows, particularly Stephen Colbert, who's the most watched host in late night. His show has become a very political show. That it cannot be discounted. It absolutely has to be considered a factor if you are turning off potentially half the audience. However, we also cannot discount the seismic technological shift. I mean, Rob, I was smiling when you came back from break and you're playing the Tonight Show theme. You know, that when the Tonight Show was on, when Johnny Carson was hosting it, when Jay Leno hosted it, you had America watching NBC from 8 to 11 p.m., watching their local news at 11, and then they just transitioned right into Johnny at 11:30. You had millions of people doing that every night. Those habits are broken permanently. You do not have even close to the same number of viewers watching NBC or CBS or ABC between 8 and 11 p.m. And if you have fewer people to begin with, you have fewer people sticking around for 11:30 and 12:30.
Is there, do you see any way to bring back that kind of common language again, where people are saying, hey, did you see who was on Carson last night or something like that? Or is that something we just can't go back to, given all the variety out there?
I think it's extremely possible. And many of the late night producers and former producers who I spoke to are optimistic that something could work. One producer posited an interesting solution to me. Now, Thursday Night Football is on the Amazon streaming service. You have 10, 11, 12 million people who are watching it on Amazon every week. When that ends, is there some sort of show that Amazon could put on, a topical live show afterwards, where people stick around for another hour? Is it going to look like the traditional late night show? No, but could you bring elements of the genre into something like that for sort of this big event programming, especially as it slowly makes its transition to streaming? That is a compelling theory, and it could work.
Now, with the couple changes we mentioned, Trevor Noah and James Corden, each on their shows for about 7 years before announcing their departures, here's a Corden talking to the entertainment news program Extra about the length of his stay on the show.
By the time we finish, I'll have done pretty much like 1,400 episodes. That's a lot. And I know that in America, these jobs are positions that people take for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. It was never, ever going to be that for me.
Yeah, who'd want to host the same talk show for more than 7 years? I don't know about that. But this idea, I mean, it used to be like, you know, you're the Pope almost. This is a lifetime appointment once you landed that late night gig. And now it seems like, I don't know, a lot of the hosts have other things they could do out there.
Yeah, that's another big part of this. As we've learned with both the Corden and Trevor Noah departures, they don't see it as a lifetime appointment and they don't want a lifetime appointment. Trevor Noah, when he broke the news to viewers that he was leaving The Daily Show, he had told very few people that he was doing that. Much of his staff didn't know, and more significantly, his bosses didn't know. He completely blindsided them, and I think it was because he just wanted to get it out of the way, announce his departure on his terms so he could leave within a couple months, and he will be gone by December. Yeah, I mean, it's a grind. These are very hard jobs, and these hosts have a lot more options now. Take Conan O'Brien. Conan O'Brien had been in late night for nearly three decades. His show on TBS, they reformatted it within the last 2 years of its life, reducing it to a half hour and focusing on one guest for an interview. It didn't work. The ratings were really, really, really low for that show. But guess what happened? Conan O'Brien had a side project going. He had a podcast, a long-form interview program, interviewing other celebrities or journalists or interesting people. That is a huge hit. It's a huge hit. And Conan O'Brien just sold his podcast network to SiriusXM. So it really was a matter of genre, where Conan O'Brien was doing it. Late night wasn't working, but podcast does.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in San Jose, Costa Rica. Paul, hi.
Hello, hello. Greetings.
What did you want to bring up, Paul?
Frequent listener from abroad. I've lived abroad for decades. I always watch the shows you're talking about. I watch them online. Thank God that they're streamed so I can see them, because I wouldn't have access to them otherwise. So I think a lot of us watch those shows, whether it's the entire show of Colbert or Trevor Noah, or we're just clicking on the interviews and pieces that we want to see, and I would be really upset to lose them, much less I don't agree that it's about woke content at all. I think they're always topical and they keep me abreast of what's going on, and I enjoy the humor and it's part of my day to always check in with them.
And Paul, I got to ask, you mentioned sometimes you just click on interviews. Do you ever watch, you know, in real time live when those shows are broadcast?
I never do. I don't know that I ever have.
Gotcha. Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that. Interesting perspective there, John, on how he uses that.
Completely. And I, you know what? He is like a lot of people out there. There are thousands and millions of people who are going to go ahead and click on a YouTube of what was Colbert's monologue last night. Oh, I heard Jimmy Fallon had Olivia Wilde on his show last night. I will watch that. And this worked for a while because there were enough viewers coming into the broadcast network where the network executives were happy. They were making plenty of money. And sure, let it be a hit on YouTube. The problem is simply the economics. You're making pennies on the dollar with those YouTube clicks. They just, if the viewers are not tuning in at high numbers into the network, the YouTube stuff just doesn't make economic sense. And these media companies have done a better job at moving a lot of this content to their own proprietary streaming services. But again, you know, how many subscribers are you going to get because you want to watch Stephen Colbert, you watch Jimmy Fallon? It may not be enough to justify the expenses of these shows. And these shows cost a lot of money. They could cost anywhere on a yearly basis between $60 and $100 million to produce.
Let's bring on another caller now. Richard is with us in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hi.
What did you want to bring up, Richard?
I want to bring up the fact that, I'm talking to some other people right now.
Oh, okay. I'll let you go then, Richard. Let's go to Charles in Merrill. Charles, hi.
Hi there. I was wondering what your guest thought of John Oliver's show. I don't know if he'd consider it a late night show or not, but he has, you know, kind of exactly what the last caller was talking about. Lots of topical, societal and political, you know, topics on videos on YouTube that are fantastic. I think he's on HBO and we've considered getting HBO because we love his show so much.
Interesting, Charles. You've written a bit, I think, John, about HBO. Thoughts on John Oliver and if he would actually be, you know, getting people to subscribe?
It's such a great question, Charles. I would say John Oliver is kind of the exception to the rule here, but he does something different, right? He's a weekly show, and he's not on 52 weeks a year. It's less than that, but it's a weekly show. It's a 30-minute show, and he usually does a little, you know, song and dance. He does, like, you know, does some comedy bits at the top, but it's usually a single topic. And it's kind of a journalistic show, too. But for the purposes of the genre, I do think it counts as a late-night show. In fact, it has won the Best Variety Talk Show Emmy Award, I believe, 7 years in a row, beating Colbert, beating Kimmel, beating Seth Meyers, year in and year out. I think one of the things that benefited John Oliver is his show started before the streaming era really began to dominate entertainment. It started as an HBO proper show. So I think he has successfully made the transition to the other side, where plenty of people are watching him on HBO Max, even if not as many people are watching him on HBO, the cable network. But John Oliver is an example of a success story here.
And speaking of shows that, like, do they fit the genre, people have pointed toward Greg Gutfeld on Fox News. So it's a more conservative leaning sort of talk show on a network where people, you know, the built-in audience would match up well with that. Where does that fit into this discussion?
It's a late night political and comedy show, and it is definitely worked. I mean, you know, Fox has, it's an 11 p.m. show. Fox has done a number of experiments at 11 p.m., and this is the one that's taken hold. Many network executives sort of bristle at the comparison that Gutfeld is the same genre as what they're doing. And notably, they will point out that he is live at 8 p.m. on the West Coast, so he gets to goose his numbers even more. And also, Fox viewers are very loyal to their network. They will stay from afternoon until night. So there is a smooth transition from Tucker to Laura Ingraham to Hannity to Gutfeld.
Now, bringing things around, you recently co-wrote a piece headlined, "Is There a Future for Late Night Talk Shows?" What are you watching for in the future? Is there going to be a late night talk show, or are we going to translate this all into, I don't know, YouTube and podcast video series? What are you watching for in the future?
In the short term, let's see who replaces Trevor Noah. Let's see who replaces James Corden. I suspect both Comedy Central and CBS are going to try to shake up the format. Not many networks have tried to shake up the format. So let's see if those efforts are successful. I have a careful eye on Stephen Colbert's contract is up next year. Does he re-sign? If he re-signs, is it a short 1 or 2 year deal, or is it a 3-4 year deal? The Tonight Show, NBC is considering giving up its 10 p.m. primetime hour and giving it to local affiliates. Does the Tonight Show move up to 10:30 or 11 p.m. if so? And does that work? Do more viewers come in to watch it? And similarly, what happens to Seth Meyers at 12:30? It's a, you know, it's a popular show. It's a niche show, but it always gets critical recognition. Does that continue to run at 12:30, or do NBC executives decide to put it on their streaming service or on their cable news network?
And finally, John, you know, if I'm watching TV after 10 o'clock, it's either I'm still watching a live sporting event or I'm pulling up something to stream, probably, you know, a TV show of some sort, fictionalized TV show. Are people like me killing this late night talk show format?
Luckily, you're not alone, so we don't have to single you out, Rob. Yes, we are collectively really getting it closer to life support because we're just not watching the way we did 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
John, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
John Coblin is a media reporter for the New York Times covering the television industry. He was with us today looking at the present and future of late night television talk shows in the streaming age. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your all-time favorite. If you had one you watched reliably every night, if you could, let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, how does the economy look from where you're sitting? If it's influencing how you're voting in the midterm election, how is it influencing your vote? We'll talk about inflation and other economic issues in the midterms. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a look at inflation and the economy in this year's election campaign. First, sometimes it's anyone's guess what candidates for public office would actually do if elected. In the race for Wisconsin governor, voters have been given more than 120 examples of what they could expect. They're all bills that pass the Republican-dominated state legislature, only to be vetoed by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. As Sean Johnson reports, those bills and many more could become law if Republican challenger Tim Michaels wins in November.
Tony Evers vetoed a total of 126 bills in the last two-year session of the legislature. Since Wisconsin became a state in 1848, no governor has vetoed more bills in a single session. Included on this list were bill after bill that would have made changes to Wisconsin election laws, including by adding hurdles to voting absentee. These were top priorities for GOP lawmakers, and at a September campaign rally, Tim Michaels tells Republican voters they'll be priorities for him.
We are going to take those bills that Tony Evers vetoed, we're going to get them right, I'm going to sign them.
It wasn't just election bills that Evers rejected. He vetoed gun bills, including one that would have proclaimed that any federal bans on assault weapons don't apply in Wisconsin. He vetoed bills that would have chipped away at the safety net, like a plan to trim unemployment benefits down from 26 weeks to as little as 14. At the same rally, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss makes reference to all of them.
It's going to happen, and I promise you, when we are here in 1 year with Governor Michaels, every single thing that Governor Evers has vetoed is going to be considered by the legislature, and hopefully all of it becomes law, because we are back to being the conservative, revolutionary place that Wisconsin was under Governor Walker.
This riles up Republicans. With one election, by winning this one race for governor, a full-speed-ahead conservative agenda could be theirs. But it also means Democrats see Evers as essential to blocking that agenda. Republican lobbyist Bill McCoshin worked for former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. Even though the former governor had a record of working with both parties, McCoshin said Thompson would brag about the Democratic policies he stopped in order to motivate GOP voters.
It shows the strength of the office and why the office is important. So highlighting that There's no downside to that, at least in my opinion. And Tommy proved that. You can be out there saying, listen, I stopped all these bad things that you, my base, are against. And that's why you need to fight hard to reelect me.
On the campaign trail, Evers is soft-spoken, low-key. During a recent campaign stop at the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, Evers asks student supporters, politely, to get out and vote.
And please vote for yours truly, a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm always going to be a Badger. Thank you.
His speech here talks about what he's for, including education funding and legalized marijuana. He doesn't talk about vetoes, but in this crowd, he doesn't have to. People say Evers' veto power is part of the reason they're supporting him. Grant Hall, a sophomore studying computer science and data science, worries about the election bills Republicans would sign without Evers.
And I feel like it'll prevent a large number of Wisconsin voters from being able to go out to the polls and have their voice heard.
Rihanna Mukherjee, a senior at the UW-Madison majoring in political science, says that without Evers, Republicans would have too much control.
I think in a democracy, you need balancing voices, and our Republican legislator doesn't balance voices.
In an interview after his speech, Evers says his vetoes reflect his value system, and people know that.
Part of my job going forward, again, the next 4 years, will be to be that goalie and prevent bad legislation from becoming law.
And if he's not governor, Evers thinks those bills will be passed and signed as quickly as possible. In the contentious race for governor, it's one issue where Evers and Republicans seem to agree. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, we've been highlighting different election issues recently on Central Time. Last week, we looked at crime, for example. Another issue that's often top of mind for voters is the economy, and lately inflation has been a big part of that story. The U.S. is among many Western countries facing long-term inflation, around 8% in the U.S., a bit higher than Canada, a bit lower than Mexico, the U.K., and the Eurozone. We've talked to economists about the factors driving inflation, including the pandemic, supply and demand, and supply chain disruptions, as well as the part played by government spending. Now we're going to get into the political side of inflation and the economy and how candidates and voters are talking about the issue. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How important is inflation and the wider economy for you as a voter? How does it motivate you on election day or when you cast your absentee ballot in advance of it? Who do you blame for high inflation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Maurice Shepard is professor of political science at Madison College. Maurice, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob.
Well, polling, Maurice, in Wisconsin and around the country shows a lot of interest, a lot of concern about inflation and the economy this time around. And traditionally, the economy is a big deal. How important do you see it being in this midterm election?
Inflation is a major issue in this election, as it is in every election. Just looking at sort of polls coming out of Wisconsin, and I think these would mirror what we see nationally, inflation is the number one issue. Here in Wisconsin, the Marquette poll then would list, and I think it's important to put inflation in context mm-hmm. with the other issues. Second would be crime, once again, gun violence. And then third would be reproductive rights, again, abortion bills, and then education, taxes, and then sort of falling sort of toward the end of the line would be immigration and climate control. But what I would also like to say about in terms of inflation and its relationship to politics is that it's important, I think, to look at this in terms of not all inflation is the same in terms of how we actually measure. And I am not an economist, but inflation is measured by looking at different economic categories. A big one would be that really hits people on a daily basis would be inflation related to food and energy. Those are essential items that everyone needs, and people see and feel that inflation on a daily basis. So while inflation sort of writ large is important in terms of politics, those particular items as they relate to inflation really have a sensitivity to, once again, politics.
I want to look at the governor's race here. Now, a governor doesn't have a lot of control over inflation, but at a debate, at the only debate in the race for governor last week, Both candidates were asked what they would do to help people deal with inflation. Democratic Governor Tony Evers answered first, mentioning that inflation is a global issue impacting people around the world. Here's some of his answer.
And I've been really hoping that the Republicans would come in a session and we could do something about it right now. But my plan is this: to mitigate against inflation, we're going to lower our taxes on our middle-class folks in the state of Wisconsin by 10%. We're going to get rid of the minimum markup law on gasoline, which could save people up to 30 cents on a gallon, and also some tax credit issues. But most importantly, the one that is most important is the one about child care, a child care credit. That way, we're giving people the money to keep the money, and we can mitigate against inflation.
And then here's Republican candidate Tim Michaels.
What are some of the problems? Joe Biden, weak on inflation, canceling the Keystone Pipeline. What can we do? We can put more money in people's pockets. I'm a businessman. I understand macroeconomics. I understand how to read a balance sheet. I'm going to do everything I can to put more money in people's pockets to help them with the price at the pump and the surging price of groceries. We're going to do massive tax reform, get more money in people's pockets here in Wisconsin, and the hardworking, taxpaying people of Wisconsin will spend more of that money on goods and services, helping make our economy here even more robust.
Now, both of them mentioning some tax cuts, putting more money in people's pockets, as Michaels put it, but that can increase demand, that can increase inflation. I don't know. Do governors really have a lot of policy tools in their toolkit, Maurice, to deal with something like inflation?
They have limited tools in their toolkit to actually sort of deal with that. But I think what really stands out in terms of, again, sort of the clip that you just played was in terms of the state income tax. I think Governor Evers mentioned he would, once again, provide some minimal, once again, sort of reduction. But for Tim Michaels, I think he's gone on the record by saying he would like to eliminate the Wisconsin state income tax altogether. And I think also during that debate later, he also addressed the rainy day fund that Governor Evers sort of touted that as a good thing in terms of that the rainy day fund for the state of Wisconsin is fully funded. And Tim Michaels responded by saying that just shows that government is taking in too much money. So I think in general for Governor Evers, he's looking at, again, sort of an incremental way to see what the state can do to reduce inflation and the harmful impacts it will have on Wisconsinites. The challenger, Tim Michaels, he's taking a much more bold approach to it by, again, proposing to eliminate the state income tax. And also what it sounds like is that he would also get rid of the rainy day fund.
On a national level, how are you seeing the two parties tackle or avoid, I guess, the issue of inflation?
On a national, in general, and history on this is not on the Democratic Party side. That in terms of inflation, the Democratic Party traditionally, and I'll just use once again, Democratic presidents, that when they were in office and inflation was high, it did not help them when it came time for re-election. So if we go back to just after World War I, Woodrow Wilson was hit with rising inflation. Warren Harding sort of won after that. Going back to the 1950s, President Truman had high inflation. Dwight Eisenhower came in and won. Same thing as we get to the 1980. Jimmy Carter did not just have inflation, he also had stagflation, which was something new at the time. And Ronald Reagan famously sort of pointed out his famous statement to the American voters, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And of course, Reagan won in a landslide. So nationally, if we use once again the national results and history, it does not look good for Democrats going into, once again, at least this midterm election.
We're talking about the economy and inflation as election issues. Maurice Shepherd is with us, professor of political science at Madison College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you rank inflation and the economy when it comes to casting your vote? Are they on your mind as you make a decision, or is there something else that gets out ahead of those issues? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you want to hear from candidates for governor, Senate, state legislature, you name it, when it comes to inflation? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Maurice Shepard, professor of political science at Madison College, looking at the economy and inflation, how influential they could be as issues in the midterms. You can let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Tim is with us on the road near Madison. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. Go for it.
Good. I tend to be sort of a little bit right of center, but I vote for Republicans and I vote for Democrats. But I think I'm on a fixed income. I'm 72 years old. And it's no accident this inflation is happening, and it's hurting people like me. I did not care for Donald Trump as a president. Personally, I thought he was a scumbag, but he was an excellent president, in my opinion. And isn't it amazing how the day he leaves office, everything turns south as far as the economy is concerned? And I got to believe it's a plan. And it's a plan that has to be stopped, or this country's going into the ditch.
Tim, thanks for the call. I don't know about the plan part of it, Maurice, but Democrats have to be worried that voters like Tim will associate inflation and blame it on Democrats.
Sure. And to follow up on what Tim is highlighting is that in terms of politics, one way to think about this is a lot of times we talk about abstract ideas, democracy, liberty, those sorts of concepts. But when we get to inflation, we're talking about something tangible that, as Tim pointed out, impacts, once again, people on a daily basis. And some of the data show that, particularly as you look at different voting groups, particularly for middle class and working class voters, it hits them really hard in terms of, once again, their quality of life and what they can do. And particularly in Tim's case, for those that are a bit older, again, maybe retired or about to retire, it hits them not just at the grocery store and at the pump, but also it will hit them in terms of medical care, medical services, and the prescriptions that they need. So for a voter like Tim, it's hitting him sort of double whammy. In terms of a conspiracy, I think what we probably are not appreciating in general, sort of, again, not any one group, but the historic nature of the pandemic, it really changed everything in a number of different ways. So if there is a conspiracy out there, I don't know exactly what it is, but I think we are still underappreciating the severity of the pandemic on our economy, on politics, and on society.
Thanks for the call, Tim. Deborah is with us now in Winona, Minnesota. Deborah, hi.
Hi. My issues are a little bit different than what your guest is talking about. For me, climate change is the big thing. And we don't even talk about the economic impact that has on people. The snow crabs in Alaska, completely destroying the crab fishery there. That's going to impact their economy a great deal. And then after the environment is women's reproductive rights and on preserving our democracy. Right now there are a lot of forces trying to change voting rights and gerrymander districts and things. And I think those are my three main issues. Inflation for me is an international issue. And
Deborah, I got you. We've got a lot of callers and I want to bring Maurice in on that. Thanks for calling in. Economy and inflation, big issues, Maurice. They are clearly not the only things on the table here.
Correct. And I think Deborah did a good job of highlighting the fact that there will always be a disconnect between when we talk about a particular policy, if it's inflation or climate change, and how that relates to politics. Politics tends to be short term in nature. We go from one election cycle to the next and that sort, while these policy issues that we have to deal with, again, climate change being very important along with inflation, those require long-term solutions. So there's always some, resistance there for short-term thinking politicians to engage in long-term action.
Thanks for that call, Deborah. Ben joins us now in Sparta. Ben, hi.
Hi. I think that the attempts on the part of the Republicans to tie inflation to government spending under President Biden and the Democrats the majority of the spending that has increased the deficit is spending that occurred because of COVID, programs to offset the problems of COVID. And the majority of that spending, which benefited a lot of people and went back to the taxpayers, that occurred under the Trump administration and the Republican and Democratic Congress.
Ben, thanks a lot for that call. It gets into some nuance, Maurice, but I have seen the case made like, yes, we have inflation. Yes, some of it is because of the spending Ben mentioned, but we have very good employment numbers, in part, people argue, because of that very spending. I don't know. Are people balancing things in as nuanced a way as Ben is, do you think?
I think Ben is probably far ahead of the game in terms of, again, looking at a complex issue and sort of untangling it. I think the truth lies somewhere in the fact that for most Americans, and some of the polling, once again, will highlight this, that when you think of government, particularly big government, people think Democratic Party. So if there is a policy or something that is taking place in which government seems to either be the source of the problem or agitating the problem, then again, sort of the Democratic Party will get, again, the lion's share of the blame for that. For the Republicans, again, they've done a very good job of crafting a message that they are the party of business, of corporate America, and that they, quote unquote, solve problems. Now, if that's truly the case or not, that's not for me to say, but I think that's the general message that most Americans have. If government is bad, they link it to the Democratic Party.
Thanks for that call. Diane joins us now in Fitchburg. Diane, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a point that I believe a big problem with all of this overall plan is profiteering. The fact that we see gas shortages or gas prices going up or wheat shortages or with cars, you know, circuit shortages, and prices go up, but then they never seem to come back down. And I see this as part of the American success story that, you know, you make a big amount of money here, there, or wherever, and that's idolized.
Diane.
And it's at the expense of us.
Diane, thanks for the call. Maurice, just cutting off because we don't have a ton of time left. Some polling suggests that I think some 70-some percent of people say blame in part corporate profiteering for inflation. 60-some percent also blame the Biden administration. But who people blame may be a factor in their political decisions.
Right. And I think, Diane, again, sort of focused in on a key issue that what we're going through right now, part of this will be maybe temporary. I looked at some recent reporting and analysis that actually what we're experiencing right now in terms of inflation will subside within the next 6 months or so. But she also highlights the importance of, and I am not an economist, mm-hmm. but in the economic literature, they call it sort of rent seeking, again, getting these extra benefits, or as Diane put it, profiteering. And this is something that just simply needs to be worked out. I am not an economist, so I'm not going to sort of go down that road, but I understand exactly what Diane is saying.
Diane, thanks a lot for that call. Maurice here in Wisconsin, there is a booming growth industry in campaign ads. Are you expecting to see a lot of attention, especially from the major statewide candidates, on the economy and inflation in the remaining few weeks?
Yes, for many of the races here in Wisconsin, almost all of the other than for the congressional race, I think the third congressional district, La Crosse, that's going to be competitive. Again, the gubernatorial race and also, again, the race for Senate, those will also be once again competitive. So, I think the advertising and promotion will just increase. The money will continue to flow in, and it will be very intense as we get closer to Election Day.
Maurice, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Maurice Shepherd, professor of political science at Madison College. We talked to them about the politics of the economy and inflation and how much of a factor they could be in the midterm election campaigns. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, comedian and mystery science theater legend Joel Hodgson joins the show for a look at bad movies and what makes them great. I don't know if often have host envy. A little bit do. Would have been fun to talk to him, but we'll get to listen to Kate do it. That is in the not-too-distant future. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30. You could join in if you're a fan with your questions or your favorite bad movies. That's coming up tomorrow on the Ideas Network. I play the saxophone. That's not me playing there, but I'm always interested in checking out performances by other sax players. That version of the theme from Love Story was played by an Italian musician a few days ago. Nothing too special about that, but it's a weird venue. It's an operating room during brain surgery, and the sax player is the patient. As reported by CBS and others, Italian surgeons removed a brain tumor from that patient. And yes, apparently you stay awake during this surgery, though I guess you don't feel it so much. Surgeons didn't want to disrupt the musician part of the patient's brain, so they had him play saxophone on and off during the 9-hour procedure. The tumor successfully removed. The patient could still play the sax. Not the first time this has happened. NPR reported on another sax performance during brain surgery back in 2017. I've had some weird gigs over the years. Nothing that can top that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.